started last week. We kicked off the new quarter. We were going to talk about between the testaments. We laid a lot of groundwork last week about the time or the period. Kind of gave an overview of what we wanted to do. And we made some foundational points that God had always spoke to man or gave his instruction through man. His mechanism for doing that, even to the day, as we're told in Romans, you know, we're to minister. The word goes out on the tongue of men, and that's always been God's mechanism. We talked about the prophets, the patriarchs, and how all that came together, and what a advantage that we have by having God's word as a finished product. That's something that our forefathers did not have. It required faith on their part to a large sense in areas that we have word and they didn't. So we kind of led up to how that the prophets brought their words. And even though we had this silence, as the world would say, for 400 years of where there was no divine revelation, but God didn't leave us without. He gave us a lot before, he gave us a lot after, and he documented the changes that occurred during that time. When we look at what he gave us before and what he gave us after this 400 years, he documented a lot that we're going to take some time and look at this quarter. I think you have to look at God's prophecy, God speaking to man through the prophets. You have to look at it. You can't look at it without setting the context or the conditions of Israel at that time, because we know our major and our minor prophets, and a lot of that prophecy that came through them was in different times spread out over quite a while. So God was revealing this for quite some time. Short history of Israel, I think it'd be a good idea to spend some time on that. We start out with the United Kingdom. We see Israel, don't we, as an infant nation, more or less. They've been in captivity for a long time. They're now out. They're on the move. They've came. They've conquered. They've kind of got set in. And we see the stage set for the first, I guess, big change that is noted in their nation. We see that the last judge, which was Samuel, of course, we've got a lot recorded from him. In 1 Samuel 8, verses 1 through 8, we read of how we took one change here, where Israel left God's system that he placed them under, and how they decided that they would reject God's system and preferred what the heathen around them had. So let's just look at that first few verses there in chapter 8. It says, "Now it came to pass when Samuel was old that he made his sons judges over Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second Abijah. And they were judges in Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain, took bribes, and perverted justice." We know that that happened throughout the nation at times. It says, "Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah and said to him, 'Look, you're old. Your sons don't walk in your ways. Now make us a king to judge us like all the nations.' But the thing displeased Samuel when they said, 'Give us a king to judge us.' So Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, 'Heed the voice of the people and all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me, that I should not reign over them. According to all the works which they have done since the day that I brought them out of Egypt, even to this day, with which they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Therefore, heed their voice. However, you shall solemnly forewarn them and show them the behavior of the king who will reign over them. We see this first change when we're setting up Israel's history of where they desired what the world had and rejected what God had given them. We know that Saul was that first king that Samuel anointed. And we see, as God forewarned them, the things that played out on that nation because of their rejection of him. But Saul was there for about 40 years. He displeased God, of course, didn't he, with his choices when he chose to serve or listen to the people rather than God, and therefore his descendants were removed from the throne, never to rule. So we see that big change early on there. Next, under the United Kingdom, we see David that comes into there. And we can look at 1 Samuel 13 and verse 14. And we're told there, "But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart," speaking of David, "and the Lord has commanded him to be commander over his people because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you." That's why we set the tone last week in Deuteronomy chapter 28, because there was so much scripture given there that clearly defined to them what the blessings and the things that they would receive for obedience, and then the hugely overwhelming amount of instruction God gave them for their disobedience and the curses that they would receive from that. That's look at Acts 13:22. It says, "And when he had removed him, he raised up for them David as king, to whom also he gave testimony and said, I have found David, the son of Jesse, a man after my own heart, who will do all my will." David, a man after God's own heart, is something that we often talk about and we often think about. We see in David a complete opposite attitude toward sin that we saw when Saul was pointed out, don't we? David was truly a man after God's own heart. So he was anointed by Samuel as this second king. We know David, as he served, he was a great military leader, wasn't he? That was really his forte. He expanded the borders, subdued most of the nations that afflicted Israel, even though they were there afflicting them because of their own wrongdoing. But David did subdue most of that, spread the borders over a huge amount. And he made the promise to David in 2 Samuel 7. That was the opposite of what he had done with Saul. 2 Samuel 7, 11 through 16. Says, "Since that time I commanded judges to be over my people of Israel and have caused you to rest from all your enemies. Also the Lord tells you that he will make you a house. When your days are fulfilled and you rest with your fathers, I will set up your seed after you, who will come from your body, and I will establish his kingdom. He shall build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom forever. I will be his father, and he shall be my son. If he commits iniquity, I will chasten him with the rod of men and with the blows of the sons of men. But my mercy shall not depart from him, as I took it from Saul, whom I removed from before you. And your house and your kingdom shall be established forever before you. Your throne shall be established forever." We see, as we spoke about last week, laying the groundwork that God worked his providence through these other nations. He worked his providence through kings and kingdoms. And that was something that went on during this 400 years just as well as it was here when we're looking at history. That was something that never stopped during that 400 years. So there's still a lot there that we can learn during that 400 years. We know that because of David's military background, he led the campaign He smote the enemies of Israel. And because there was so much blood associated with David, that God chose that he would not build the temple. So Solomon succeeded David, didn't he? That gives us our third king, our third and last king of Israel as a united nation, as a united kingdom. Look at 1 Kings 4. Judah and Israel were as numerous as the sands by the sea in multitude, eating and drinking and rejoicing. So Solomon reigned over all the kingdoms from the river to the land of the Philistines, as far as the border of Egypt. They brought tribute, they served and served Solomon all the days of his life. Now Solomon's provision for one day was 30 cores of fine flour, 60 cores of meal, 10 fatted oxen, 10 oxen from the pastures, and 100 sheep besides deer, gazelles, roebucks, and fattened fowl. For he had dominion over all the region on this side of the river, from Tiphsah even to Gaza, namely over all the kings on this side of the river, and he had peace on every side all around him. And Judah and Israel dwelt safely, each man under his vine and his fig tree, from Dan as far as Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. See a glorious time, don't we, under Solomon. We see a lavish, very good time for the country, a peaceful time on the wings of David that had put down a lot of the oppression that was around him. And now we see progress, or we see how profit had really increased and how he had built this great kingdom. And Solomon, you look at Solomon, David was the victor as far as the one taken. He was the military guy. Solomon was the builder. That's what he was known for. Even in secular history, Solomon, his reputation is for his building programs. Not just the temple that we often look at, but the royal palace. A lot of great things under Solomon, under this time of lavish excess, I would say, in some instances. He built the temple, of course, because David, his father, had been forbidden to build that. Great times, even though God had spoke to them, certainly had been no silence on the subject of the kings. He had warned them what's going to come with this. They wanted it anyway. As we see in God's character in many other instances, he will give people over to what they demand if they refuse and reject him and will not return to him. So they have their nations, but their kings. But you think, through this, God is still playing out his providence, regardless of that. He's going to play out his plan. As we talked about Wednesday, that's not going to be thwarted. God's playing this plan out. It was made before the beginning of time, so it's going to happen. It's not like some of the world looks at the developments that we see through Israel nation, that God's on this ping pong path trying to get this plan. God knows everything. He had this plan set, and this is what it took to work this plan out. So he's playing out his providence with this nation of Israel, of course, to bring Jesus Christ into the world through. So we see after Solomon's gone, the kingdom divides, don't it? Northern kingdom starts out on a horrible foot. We know that it consists of the ten tribes. Jeroboam was his first king, and it dates itself around 931 to 910 B.C. So you see, it's back not hardly 1,000 years, but it's back 9:31 to 9:10, when they split here and Jeroboam becomes this first king of Israel. The southern kingdom, Judah, of course, had Benjamin and Judah, the two tribes of it, and Rehoboam is over them, as we've studied in our history. And he didn't look like, if you're into numbers, B.C.-wise, they were very similar in the time that they served together. They both started together, and they served within a few years of each other. So their serving as kings were pretty close to each other, according to the dates that we do have. We know that with the northern kingdom, we learn from our youth up, they had no good kings, did they? And you think about it, and you can completely understand. I mean, look at the footing that they started off on. They started off with a divided kingdom that didn't even have Jerusalem within it. So automatically Jeroboam has to go on this defensive to try to keep the people in his kingdom and from going to Jerusalem in the southern kingdom for fear of losing their loyalty. So he sets up, you know, idols in Dan and Beersheba. He sets up these substitute temples and convenience for the people that was under his reign to try to keep them there. All along, he's undermining God's plan and in rejection of God. They were steeped in idolatry worship from the very beginning. I mean, even the placing of those by Jeroboam, Dan and Beersheba, the placing of the idols there. I mean, they started off that way and never pulled out of that. Israel just completely and continuously slid into more and more and more problems, terrible depths of idolatry and sin. But even as bad as things were getting during that time, God still was not silent, was He? God did not give up on them. God still spoke to them as they went through this. That's one of the points that we're building here by going through this history of God's speaking. God's speaking, a lack of silence, in other words. He sent Elijah, Elisha, Amos, Hosea. He sent these prophets to the northern kingdom to try to turn them, to try to save them, to try to get them back on a path for Him. Amos, in about 755 B.C., if you're a chronological person in any numbers, you can keep up with this. In about 755 B.C., around there, condemned the unsocial practices, the extravagant but the empty worship, formal worship that they were involved in. As always, political corruption and gain and all that through their leaders, was they were plagued by that. They had more or less rotted from the inside out, and they were suffering from all this. Can't help but think about Hosea as one of those prophets. The very condition that he was in with his marriage with Gomer, I mean, the harlotry that was involved that exhibited exactly what God was facing with the harlotry that was involved with His people, His nation. Just a horrible scene, time as these kingdoms continue to slide. But all along, God's not silent. God's not giving up. God still speaks, and He's still playing out His plan, of course. We know that Israel does not relent, does not turn. It finally falls to Assyria. In 722, we'll go into more depth than that, but we'll read from 2 Kings 17, or just refer to 2 Kings 17 because we're going to go into more depth on Assyria a little bit later. But we see the captivity of Samaria in verses 5 and verses 6 there. Go back up to 1 in chapter 17. It says, "In the 12th year of Ahaz, king of Judah, Hosea the son of Eli became king of Israel in Samaria, and he reigned 9 years. And he did evil in the sight of the Lord, but not as the kings of Israel who were before him. Shalmaneser, king of Israel, came up against him. Hosea became his vassal, paid tribute money. The king of Assyria uncovered a conspiracy by Hosea, for he had sent messengers to So, king of Egypt, and brought no tribute to the king of Assyria, and he had done as he had done year by year. Therefore, the king of Assyria shut him up, bound him up in prison. Now the king of Assyria went throughout the land and went up to Samaria and besieged it for 3 years. And in the 9th year of Hosea, the king of Assyria took Samaria and carried Israel away to Assyria and placed them in Hala and by the Habor, the river of Gozan, and in the cities of the Medes." 3 years that he besieged Samaria there before it fell. These were things that happened to these people that they certainly suffered for because of their choices a lot. But she went in. We see where Israel goes into captivity here and more or less is gone. It's absorbed, dispersed, spread out, whatever, and more or less observed. And she, to our divine revelation that God gives us, never returns. I mean, it's gone. On the other hand, we see a little bit of difference in the divided kingdom when it comes to Judah. We see from Judah, they had a few good kings that ruled her, a few good kings that turned them, that kind of temporarily corrected them or bent them or headed them back in the right direction. They were kings that made great efforts in destroying the idolatry and removing it, wiping it out and cleaning it out in its physical form. However, we know that the idols are not just a physical thing. They're in the heart too, and they never could wipe them out of the people's hearts, really. But they did restore worship to God. They removed some of the old idols. And we know, we mentioned this Wednesday night, when Assyria tried to take Judah, King Hezekiah, who served from about 716 B.C. to 687 B.C., he was a good king, Hezekiah was. He appealed, you know, to Isaiah. We know that from our history, who prayed to God to spare the people. And that's when God slew the 185,000 Assyrians that had laid siege. And they left and failed to take the southern kingdom. If you remember, we mentioned that Wednesday night and took a little moment to reflect on how man's secular history recorded that. Because the king of Assyria recorded a different, not a different, but a misleading historical record of what happened there. He recorded it as just being, he hemmed up the king, he hemmed up the town as a bird in a cage, and he reported it as though that was his sentence on them. He never mentions that he failed to take it. He never mentions his failure and his losses. That doesn't come out. So we see how man can sometimes skew history in his own favor, as many of the other nations did that time, as well as the Egyptians. We talked about that before. 2 Kings 19, 35 and 37. It says, "And it came to pass on a certain night that the angel of the Lord went out and killed in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. And when a people arose early in the morning, there were corpses all dead. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went away, returned home, and remained at Nineveh. And it came to pass as he was worshiping the temple of the Nisroch, his god, his sons Adarmak and Sharazar struck him down with a sword, and they escaped to the land of Ararat. Then Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his place. But we see there that the angel of the Lord smote those and actually bent history. What man would seem was going to happen to Judah, just as it happened to Israel, God steps in through his angel and he turns that fate. God continued to spare Judah for a few more years, no doubt because of this influence that the good kings had on the people. Hezekiah, Josiah was two that comes to mind that were good. Josiah was one that served 641 to 609 B.C. You see us playing up from where we started at the way up in the 900 B.C.s. As history gets up, when you're getting up around the 600s, you know, you're getting close to that 400-year mark. So kind of helps you if you're a chronological thinker, keep it sorted in your mind of how things are playing out on a timeline. But we know, don't we, from history and from God's recording, Judah was becoming more and more corrupt, weren't they? They continued just as Israel did, even though they had a few interruptions and returns. All in all, they continued and continued and continued to fall away. Most of the people, I think, it's the same thing as we can account as we did in Israel. You can remove the idol from the country, but you can't remove the idol from the heart. And this just continued to feed on these people. Worship for them, if you'll remember when Stephen was here and held our meeting, and he went over the burnt sacrifices, the peace and the sin offerings, he went through all this. These physical things that were foreshadows of things to come later spiritually easily become arduous to them. They got tired of it. They would grow. Oh, they would start shortcuts. That is something that men have to guard against in all aspects. It's something that we all have to guard, whether it's our work, whether it's our worship, no matter what it is. We have to be vigilant to keep ourselves zealous, to keep ourselves fired up to work, because what they're suffering from is no different than what all men suffer from. The difference is God gave them instruction and continued to give them instruction. He was not silent that would spare them from this, and yet, just as we do today, They didn't follow it. God didn't fall silent to Judah, just as he did not fall silent to Israel. He continued to prophesy. Isaiah in 740 to about 690 B.C. prophesied during the reign of Uzzah, king from about 767 to 740. And Jotham, about year 740 to 732, and reigns of Uzzah, which was 767 to 740. Of course, Jotham was 740, 732. Ahaz, 732 to 716, and Hezekiah. So, Isaiah, you know, he spoke against these vices. These vices were always, God always made them aware of what their problems were and what was undermining them and what was working them up. He warned them of God's wrath, as Isaiah did. All these prophets did. They foretold of things that were going to be in this 400 years, of things that were coming after those years. God, even though was silent during this time between the Testaments, was filling in a lot before and filled in a lot afterward. They weren't being left to fumble and bumble lost. He even painted a good picture. I mean, when you finish up with Isaiah, of the future glory that awaited them. He wasn't the only prophet that did that. That even though all this was coming, there was going to be a future, glory that was to come. Micah, a contemporary of Isaiah, prophesied from about 735 to 700 B.C. He also cried out against these things, oppression of the poor, all these things that had come about. And a lot of it he came about because of their prosperity. What happens to us when we prosper?
We become proud and think that that's just from us.
Right. We get fat and lazy, don't we, to put it bluntly. Something else that man has to vigilantly guard against. We get confident and we get resting on our own laurels and we quit pushing forward and we continue to decay. Zephaniah also was a prophet from 630 to 625 B.C. who also prophesied of a restoration, and he saw and prophesied of this of a growing threat that was coming to Judah. God was speaking through these guys of this that was coming, destruction and these things that were coming to them through Babylon. Jeremiah spent 40 years from 625 to 586. He spent some 40 years trying to avert this Babylonian captivity that was coming. He warned the people that they would be taken as slaves to Babylon for 70 years. Look at Jeremiah 25:11. It says, "And this whole land shall be a desolation and an astonishment, and these nations shall serve the king of Babylon 70 years." God is not silent on this. He spoke through the prophets, and they were made aware of a lot of this. But nobody heeded his warning. Habakkuk, another prophet that we mentioned Wednesday night, from 612 to 606, we're getting up close to our ending time, cried to God because of the wickedness that he saw into Judah at that time and the doom that was coming at the hands of the Babylonians. He prophesied that God's judgment was coming to Judah to purge her of her evil, to more or less to accomplish something good. Look at Habakkuk 1:5-6, and we'll end here, take our break. It says, "Look among the nations and watch. Be utterly astounded, for I will work a work in your days which you would not believe, though it were told to you. For indeed, I am raising up the Chaldeans." Now, the Chaldeans were later absorbed by the Babylonians. That's what's considered the Babylonians. It says, "A bitter and a hasty nation which marches through the breadth of the earth to possess dwellings that are not theirs." So he's warning them of this onslaught that was going to wipe through the world and to take these things that were not theirs. They were a power that was coming upon them. So the divided kingdom, Israel and Judah, were both warned. God spoke. God was not silent. God spoke to them through their prophets. We'll pick up maybe Wednesday night, depending on how scheduling goes here, with the Babylon captivity, and we'll mention a thing or two about it, and the restoration of a remnant, and that will set the stage for us to bring up Micah, where we can make another point, and then we'll be ready to move on. Maybe look at some of these nations that we refer to, some of the things that God said about them, some of these powers that came into existence that were prophesied of. So Malachi will be where we're shooting for next week. to set up for the rest of the study. Any questions, anything? A lot of the history, a lot of the dates, I have to go to sources for a lot of this stuff, so please study with me. If there's anything you see that's wrong, misleading, please let me know, and I'll try my best to correct it.